Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Still We Speak podcast. This is Cole Fakes. I'm joined by Terry Fakes for one of our several Holy Week podcasts. If you're listening to this on Wednesday, 2 days ago on Monday, we had Dr. Kim Arnold on to talk about the songs of Holy Week and some great moments to meditate on. Tomorrow, we'll have audio of your great Maundy Thursday message that you give each year. We'll have that for you. And then we've got blogs all week, just meditating, thinking about Holy Week leading up to Easter. And so it's a week packed with opportunities to stop and meditate and prepare our hearts for Easter. And so when we were discussing what we wanted to do for a Holy Week podcast, we thought, you know, we both kind of have an interest in talking about something that, while it doesn't get talked about very much during Holy Week, is one of the crucial characters of the Easter story, and that is Pontius Pilate.
A lot of interest in the Roman participation and the Roman part of what happened in Jesus' life, the Roman Empire, the background of Roman rule, the oppression. A lot of the Roman citizens and characters in this story really affect it, but probably no one more so than Pontius Pilate, about whom a remarkably small amount is actually known from history.
Yeah, if you think about it, we just got done with our Empire series, and of course now we're in the Roman Empire, the totalizing, enveloping military force in the world. They rule in some ways similarly to a couple of the other empires that we've talked about, and in some ways nothing like the other empires we've talked about. Administratively, maybe they're most similar to the Assyrians in that they are very, very sophisticated in the way that they rule. And that comes into the story in a big way. But the Roman Empire makes its presence known everywhere in the gospel stories. I mean, even from the very beginning, you see that Mary and Joseph are going to Bethlehem because of a decree that's issued by the Romans that they need to be taxed, they need to be accounted for. And then here at the end, you have a Roman prefect who's ordering the execution of Jesus. The book of Acts ends in Rome when Paul has finally made it to the celestial city of Rome, which is an ironic twist in the gospel story. It's supposed to be the city that lasts forever, and yet the Bible reveals that that city will fall and there will be another city that lasts forever. I mean, this is intertwined all the way through the Bible. And Pontius Pilate, I think, is probably the one person in the gospels other than Jesus who, just on his own, without anybody else doing anything differently, could have radically changed the end of the story. And that's a really interesting feature of the way that he plays in the story. He's, on the one hand, very unknown. On the other hand, very, very influential. And when you start to read up on Pontius Pilate, one of the interesting things is how little is actually known about him and how much has been written about him. There are hundreds and hundreds of things written about him, starting from the very earliest time in Christian history, especially in the Middle Ages. People loved to write things and talk about Pontius Pilate in the medieval church. And then up through modern times, you have plays, novels, all kinds of things written about Pontius Pilate. And when you scrape together the facts that we actually know about him, you're not working with much. We actually don't even really know what his name is. His praenomen, which would be his personal name, we don't know.
Pontius
is probably a clan name of some kind. He is probably from the Pontius clan. That's kind of a family name, like our last names. Pilate or Pilatus is a description. It's a moniker that was given. It can mean good with a spear. It can be a kind of helmet. We don't know. Mm-hmm. But we only know those two names. We don't know the name that his mama gave him. We have no idea. And in addition to that, we don't even know where he was born. There are some good conjectures about where he was born. I think there's probably three prominent conjectures about where he's born, but we don't even know where he's from. So in some ways, it's the perfect thing to write tons about because it's a totally blank canvas that you can impose almost anything on.
And people have, just from what is known about him from the Gospels, and you get this sense of knowing, first of all, he's a Roman. And so he's not only a Roman, he's a Roman prefect, which means that he has military power. He has the power of the courts. He's the chief magistrate of Judea. And he has fiscal responsibilities. He's responsible for collecting and remitting taxes. So when you think about those three roles of a prefect, he has a lot of power. So you know that about him. And then when you get into the gospel accounts, you see him wielding that power, but uncertainly when he comes into contact with Jesus. And I think that dynamic has spawned a lot of sympathetic, perhaps, literature towards Pontius Pilate.
Yeah, it's interesting how he becomes the prefect of Judea. We don't know who was instrumental in that. It's likely that he had powerful benefactors. That's the way society worked in the Roman Empire in the upper echelon, is you either had somebody who had taken an interest in you and supported you financially, you had a friendship with somebody who was maybe a proconsul or an emperor, you had a family that was notorious, powerful. We don't know what category Pilate falls into. He clearly had some strong relationships in Rome, the most prominent being a relationship with Tiberius Caesar, who is Caesar Augustus dies, but he's adopted a stepson, Tiberius, who is the Roman emperor for almost all of Jesus's life, from AD 14 to AD 37. And somehow, some way, Pontius Pilate has a relationship with him. It's possible, too, that somebody who's serving as the leader of the Praetorian Guard named Sejanus is maybe a benefactor of his as well, but we really don't know. But in order to get picked to be in one of these governor roles, as you said, you usually were some kind of military commander earlier in your career. You've been not a general, not the head of a legion, but somebody in command of troops, somebody that's relationally connected. And if the opening comes at the right time and you're in the right place, you get sent out into the empire to essentially perform the duties of a governor, as you listed. Now, Judea is an interesting place to go. It's not a plum job by any means. In fact, it's surrounded by two very prominent jobs where you'd have prefects, Syria and Egypt. And it was subject to the prefect of Syria. So it doesn't even stand alone in your stature as the governor, as the prefect there. Pilate is the fifth prefect in Judea, and it's kind of interesting how there is a prefect in Judea, because you'll notice at the beginning of the gospel stories, there's no prefect. There's a king, King Herod. Right. Mm-hmm. And Herod was just a master at using his influence in Rome to get what he wanted, which basically was more power, more money, more prestige, more ability to do whatever he wanted. But when Herod the Great dies and divides up his kingdom, Rome is not as hot on his successors as he was. And so eventually what they decide to do is send in their own people to manage Judea. It's a very difficult area to manage. Herod has some major pros and cons. If you've read the Bible, you realize there's some major pros and cons with the Herods. And Rome decided, let's just keep this a little bit closer to us. And so one of the unique things about the prefect in Judea is they were not under the control of the Senate like many of the prefects were. It was actually a job that was appointed by and overseen by the emperor himself. And so Pilate is the stand-in for the authority of the emperor in Judea. One of the other things that's kind of interesting about this post is he has about 4,000 soldiers at his disposal that are wherever he is. So the seat of the prefect in Judea is in Caesarea up on the sea. And this is a city that Herod had built. And it's, a couple of days journey away from Jerusalem if you're walking and bringing troops. And he would go to Jerusalem at certain times of the year, certainly at the Passover, which is why he's there during Holy Week. But otherwise didn't spend that much time in Jerusalem. Instead, you were up a little bit away from the action. But because things did get contentious in Judea, he had 4,000 troops at his disposal, and there were four legions in Syria under the command of the Syrian prefect that could be called in. And they were called in Judea a couple of times when Pilate was the prefect. Like you said, they encompass what we would consider major government responsibilities, major fiscal responsibilities, judicial responsibilities. Their word essentially was law in the area that they were managing. But the underbelly of this is they didn't have a sealed communication between the people that they were governing. The Jews, for example, had a lot of pull in Rome, and there was a group of Jews in Rome who were constantly talking about what was going on in Judea. And maybe this is a good way to set up the predicament that Pilate finds himself in.
Yeah, it does. In fact, if I can jump forward just a little bit, we don't know how he ended his prefecture. He ruled basically from 26 till 37 when Tiberius died effectively. But according to Josephus, who's an early Jewish historian, he was called back to Rome because of the violence with which he suppressed a riot. And so on the one hand, he had Jews, as you said, Cole, in Rome, who were very influential, that there was money flowing from the Jews to Roman politicians. But he also had to stop a revolt. And so he was really walking a tightrope with the Jews and the Jewish leaders. He wanted to do what he could for them to keep them happy. On the other hand, he was ultimately responsible for keeping order. And so as we meet Pontius Pilate during Holy Week, he is in Jerusalem for the Passover, where there are so many Jews, and one spark could ignite a revolt. And he has his soldiers there, and he's caught between the desires of the Jewish leaders to get rid of this preacher, Jesus. And the other side is the fact that Jesus is so popular with the people, for Pontius Pilate to do something drastic to him risked a rebellion. And so Pontius Pilate finds himself in the middle of that precarious balance, and it all comes to a head during Holy Week.
Yeah, this is what you'd call a very stressful job. In the 10 years that he's there, he has four major revolts. One right when he gets there because of his relationship to the emperor cult. The Jews didn't like having somebody sent there that was so pro-emperor cult, and so they revolted. When he sent troops to dismiss them, they said that they would rather die than leave. And that was a little bit of a wake-up call, I think, for Pontius Pilate. He tried to use temple funds to build an aqueduct. People didn't like that, so they revolted.
Right.
He brought in troops and brutally suppressed that revolt. Of course, you have the revolt leading to Jesus' crucifixion. And then interestingly, as you mentioned, a few years later, maybe just 3 years later, depending on when you start to date Jesus' death and when this event happened, 2-3 years later, he has another revolt around a Samaritan prophet claiming to be a Messiah. And he takes a very different approach to this one than he did with Jesus. You know, with Jesus, it's kind of the give in to the masses, let them have their way, and one can die on behalf of the people, which is just brilliantly orchestrated for the gospel message. But afterwards, Pilate decides to take a different tack. This Samaritan prophet and his followers are causing a lot of problems, and Pilate calls in a bunch of troops and they massacre this movement. And that's probably the thing, again, we don't know, but that's probably the thing that gets him called back. And so you have to wonder a little bit if he was maybe learning a lesson from Jesus. How did he view the situation with Jesus? But it was never more than a year or two at a time without a giant revolt on his hands. And he tried several different tactics to deal with it, ultimately unsuccessful. The other thing that people need to know about the prefect in Judea is that the prefect could appoint and remove the high priest. This sounds very odd because the high priest, you know, if you're reading your Bible, the high priest should be a Levite who is a representative of the people, who is chosen once a year to do things like the Day of Atonement. But at this time, actually, the temple and the priesthood are much more political than they are religious. And so these high priests they're not Pharisees. I mean, Caiaphas, who's the high priest during the time of Pilate being the prefect, is a Sadducee. He's not somebody that we should think of as very devoted to studying the scriptures, very orthodox, following the law. He's a Sadducee. He believes in the first five books, very much more interested in the politics and the power and the prestige of the position. And what's interesting about Pilate is usually these prefects trade out the high priest pretty frequently, depending on which way the wind's blowing, who's got their cause in mind and who they can trust. Pilate actually keeps Caiaphas, as best we can tell, keeps Caiaphas in the spot as the high priest almost the entire time that he's the prefect. And this reveals something that's very instrumental in the Holy Week story. Caiaphas, who is a Jew, and Pilate, who is a Roman, contrary to what you might think, are actually on the same team here. Right. Pilate is kind of a protector for Caiaphas, but Caiaphas is essentially is blackmailing Pilate in the sense that if things start to go wrong with Pilate, he's got a lot more sway than Pilate does in some ways. And so there's this interesting mutual relationship between Caiaphas, the high priestly party who wants to put Jesus to death, Pilate, who is the Roman prefect who has the ability to put Jesus to death. And sometimes we read this story as if the Jews and the Romans are against each other. But part of the right. marvel of this story is because of the relationship between Pilate and Caiaphas, you actually have the Sadducees, the high priestly group, who is allied with their oppressors, Rome.
Right.
And that sets the scene for Holy Week. When Jesus is on trial, one of the things we've got to realize is there is a lot of backroom deal-making relationships at play that we've got to think about as we start to read about these trials.
That's exactly right. And that I'm glad you pointed that out, because the general population, of course, hated the Romans and wanted to be free. But this is one of those truisms of politics makes for strange bedfellows. And in this case, Caiaphas and the priestly class and Pilate had a mutually beneficial relationship. They didn't like each other, but they both profited from cooperation. And I think that's part of what I think it'll be interesting as we get into this to find out, why was Pilate as even as reluctant as he was? How hard is it to kill one Jewish preacher?
One other thing on that relationship that's interesting, it goes back to our episode on Greece, is if you remember the story of the Maccabees who rise up and throw off the Greek rule, they get to rule for a long time, 100 years or so, and then they are subject to the Romans through the Herods, who come out of that Maccabean family. Herod marries a Maccabean princess, and he has a Maccabean line in his family. So there's still this kind of, this is how we rule ourselves aspect of right. the leadership. However, when the Romans come in, one of the things that they do is they forcibly seize the priestly vestments from the king priestly family that preceded the Herods. And they keep the priestly vestments in the Antonia Fortress, which is on the outside of the Temple Mount complex. And so one of the ways that Pilate has some leverage is he gets to control when the priest gets to wear the vestments and do the holy rituals. On the flip side, Caiaphas gets to control whether or not the people rise up and cause revolts against right. Pilate. So as you said, that just another layer of this kind of contentious but allied relationship that the two of them have together.
Which all sets the stage for the Jews having, we know that Caiaphas has this mock trial, so to speak, and he whips up a crowd and realizes that in order to kill Jesus, I mean, I think they've tried to kill Jesus before this surreptitiously, but at this point in public, in Passover, the only way to kill Jesus is to take him to Pontius Pilate, because he has the power, the legitimate power to put someone to death. But they don't really have a good charge, because the charge is purely religious, and that is he claims to be Son of God, and the Romans, I don't care. And the Jews are like, oh, we really care. That's blasphemous. So, you know, they kind of mock it up and they say, instead of coming to Pontius Pilate and saying he's done something religiously wrong, he deserves to die, they come to Pontius Pilate, which is embarrassing, by the way, and say, he claims to be the king of the Jews, and we consider that to be a, quote, federal crime, a crime against Caesar. First of all, think how embarrassing this is for Caiaphas. We want you to kill him because he says he's king of the Jews, and we have our allegiance to Caesar. And Pilate realizes pretty quickly this is a bit of a trumped up charge. And that sets the stage for the back and forth that we see as they bring him before Pontius Pilate.
Right. It would not be in Pilate's best interest to get in the middle of a religious dispute, you know, denominational right. intramural dispute between the Jews. But part of this, part of the reason that they have to trump up these charges you know, one, Jesus is innocent, but two, the charges are in some sense personal to Caiaphas and the other priestly Pharisaical groups. Right. Jesus is upsetting the order. He is challenging their power. Some people conjecture, I don't know that we have this for certain, but some people conjecture that Caiaphas is the one who institutes the moneylenders in the temple. It certainly happened about that time. And so after the triumphal entry, Jesus is being proclaimed as a king. He comes into the temple. He chases out the moneylenders. And he says, you know, you've turned my father's house into a den of thieves. That is not good PR for Caiaphas and right. the people who are running the temple. And so in some ways, it's a huge slap in the face to Caiaphas and a challenge to his rule for Jesus to come in and do something like that in the temple.
You know, to corroborate what you're saying, in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 27, when Pilate gets to the point where he says, I'll give you Jesus or I'll give you Barabbas, in chapter 27, verse 18, it says, for he, Pilate, knew that it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. Pilate's not a fool. It's like you said, Cole, he realizes, okay, Caiaphas, you got some personal issue with this guy, and that's really not my business. And so he's not a fool. He understands that this is a personal envy that's driving this charge.
Right. So they try him in their own court. They've got to bring him to Pilate. But one of the things that's so funny in John chapter 18, it says in verse 28, they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. I mean, this is Jesus' criticism of the authorities in Israel to a T. We can't go into the governor's headquarters because that would make us unclean. But we can kill this guy and lie about it and have a kangaroo court and all of that, and eat the Passover just fine, because that technically wouldn't make us unclean. I mean, this is the make sure you look good on the outside. Oh, we wouldn't dare go into the prefect's headquarters. But inside, the corruption of we've got to figure out a way to kill this guy. We got to lie about it. We got to keep the people from uprising because he's threatening our power. To them, that doesn't technically make you unclean. And so you have a revelation all throughout this trial. And this is what really brings the story of Pilate to a boiling point of what the Jews are actually doing, what the Jewish leaders are actually doing, and the difficult position that it puts Pilate in.
It does indeed. And going back to John, you notice that when picking up where you left off, where they bring him to Pilate, of course, they don't enter, but they say, you know, what accusation are you bringing against this man? And they answered, if he weren't doing evil, we wouldn't have delivered him over. In other words, we don't really have a charge. We just need you to kill him. So do it.
Take our word for it.
Yeah, just trust us. He deserves to die. And then, of course, they go to their fallback, and that is, well, if you really need a charge, he says he's king, which is treason against Caesar. So if you need a charge, there's a charge. And you realize that in verse 33 of chapter 18, Pilate goes in and asks Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? And the reason Pilate asks him that is that's the charge. He right. knows better, but that's the charge. But he doesn't get the answer he expects from Jesus. In fact, this whole conversation doesn't really go the way he's used to this conversation going.
Yeah, this is an interesting feature of the Gospels, but it's also an interesting feature of history. It is rare for a prefect to be questioning a criminal himself. Usually right. they would have servants, our equivalent of lawyers, who would do this, who would essentially do a deposition, ask some questions, bring it back to the prefect so that he wouldn't have to be in this neck deep as Pilate is. Part of it is because it is the festival. Part of it is because it's early in the morning. But part of it is because Pilate doesn't have the imperial staff, the staff in his office right. that many of these other prefects do. And so you get this very odd historical phenomenon of the Roman prefect himself questioning a garden variety criminal, you know, from their vantage point. So Pilate, of course, is going to be looking down on this criminal. And certainly he thinks that he is owed a certain level of respect since he holds this person's future in his hands. And Jesus is not playing the part. In fact, if you just strip the two pieces of dialogue apart, you would almost think these were two different conversations. The questions that Pilate is asking, the answers that Jesus is giving, they do not go together. So he asks him, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus says, do you say this or do others say it about? I mean, this is just a bizarre answer. And this is a feature of the way that John records what Jesus is saying is, whether it's the woman at the well or several other encounters, Jesus talks about what's most important, whether or not the other person is talking about what's most important. He's going straight to the heart. He's actually asking a question about Pilate himself. Pilate thinks they're discussing the charges. Jesus is discussing the heart of Pilate, which it sets up maybe the most interesting line in this exchange, which Jesus finally says, you say that I'm a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. This is, in some ways, almost a plea, or at least a opportunity for Pilate to say, do you listen to the truth or not? Pilate responds with this very famous line, what is truth? And when you read that, I've heard this preached, read commentaries on it. Unfortunately, we don't know how this was said. We don't know the intonation. We can't see the body language. But people take it different ways in terms of how is Pilate saying this. What do you think about what Pilate is saying here, how he means it, where he's coming from? How do you take this question?
Great question. I have a definite opinion about this, and I can't be absolutely certain, but it seems to me, first of all, Pilate is the quintessential modern man, modern secular man, in that you have two fundamental motivations, in my view. This will explain why I take it the way I do. And that is, you have the pursuit of truth and the pursuit of power. And I do believe that the secular world is engrossed in the pursuit of power. No matter what lipstick you put on that argument, it's about power. And you can become jaded very quickly. For example, just look at our political situation now. Many people are jaded, of whatever persuasion, at the honor and justice of our system. In other words, there's no truth. It's just what's in my best interest. Truth versus power, I think, are the two things then and now. Pontius Pilate, to me, is a politician. I mean, by the nature of his job, he's a politician. He is used to balancing power so that he doesn't get caught in the wheels of Roman politics. And so I think Pilate is experienced enough to be so jaded that is there really anything that's true, or is it really just all about who's in power? And I think he represents all of us to some extent in that. And so Jesus comes to him and says, there is a truth. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I'm putting words in his mouth here. And everybody on the side of truth listens to me. Will you listen to me? And I think the answer comes from jaded humanity. I think Pontius Pilate is a jaded, secular human being who says truth. There's no such thing as truth. It's about power. And in that situation, Jesus acts like he has the power. And, you know, he doesn't act like he's afraid of the power. The truth is what he's wearing. But Pontius Pilate looks at that situation and says, you're the weakest guy in this whole situation. Whereas we look at it and we go, paradoxically, Jesus is the most powerful guy in this situation. So I take that statement, Cole, to be the jaded statement of humanity who has come to the conclusion that truth is no more than the will of the stronger. Mm-hmm. But how do you see it? That's not the only way to look at it. That's just the way I've typically looked at it. And I can envision Pilate's personality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that, because I think what he's saying, you hear people talk about it, he's saying this dismissively or kind of mockingly. I don't necessarily think it's that. I think it's Pilate kind of in a bewildered, this is not even the right, what are you talking about? What is truth? Mm-hmm. No, it's not truth. It's whether or not you're guilty and whether or not you get to walk away here. That's what we're talking about. And truth has nothing to do with
that. And truth has nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
Right.
That's kind of the way I take this too, is he's a pragmatic guy. He's used to doing what works. He's not interested in a philosophical, ethical discussion with one of these Jewish teachers. And if you read it that way, the conversation actually gets even more interesting as you go into chapter 19, because he decides, okay, I'm just going to do something pragmatic. I'm going to pit this against an alternative. Got this murderer rioter here named Barabbas. You know, should we send him out or should we send Jesus out? And the people want Barabbas. So he's kind of at a loss here. So he has Jesus flogged, which buys him some time. And the people are still revolting. And at this point, Pilate is in a very difficult position, because if he allows this revolt to go on, he risks his own future as the prefect. Right. And certainly if you think that there's something else going on, you know, some people conjecture that maybe his benefactor in Rome dies in 31, which puts him in a bit of a difficult position. He's a bit out on a limb here. He may not have any more chances. He may be worried about being recalled. But on the flip side, if he lets this guy go, who claims to be king and claims to be the son of God instead of Caesar, then he's going to get recalled. I mean, it's a true no-win situation. He's trying to figure out how to thread the needle here. So he basically decides to mock him and see if that works with the Jews. And that's where you get this line. Jesus comes out wearing the crown of thorns, purple robe. Pilate says, "Behold the man." This is kind of a mocking. Okay, here's the guy. Here's the one that's quote unquote king. Look at him now. Are you happy?
Yeah, that is a great point. You've set this up well. He is trying to thread the needle in this dilemma. And first, you know, he says, "Well, you know what? It's the habit to release someone. Do you want me to release him or Barabbas, who's a robber?" And of course, this whipped up crowd, partisan crowd, says, "We want Barabbas." And he's like, "You've got to be kidding me. That was an easy way out." So then he moves on, as you said, and he says, "Well, I'll just beat the tar out of the guy and we'll humiliate him. And that's going to be enough. And Caiaphas, read my lips. This is enough. Let it go." I mean, it's almost like he's sending that message. And he said, "All right, everybody's proved their point here. We beat him up. And that's good enough." And both of those I read as an attempt to do what you said, thread the needle out of in this dilemma and come out of it without upsetting Caiaphas and his crowd, but also without killing Jesus and risking all the rest of the people that love him waking up the next morning and potentially revolting against him. So he does have quite a dilemma. So neither one of those two things work. And then, so he goes back and just said, "I'm done." But then something happens that really upsets the apple cart, I think. And there are two events here. The first one, if you read this carefully in chapter 19, so he goes back and he says, "See, here's the man." And so then they start shouting, "Crucify him, crucify him." And Pilate said to him, "You guys crucify him," meaning you can't. He said, "But I don't find anything wrong with him." And then the Jews say this in verse 7, the Jews answered him and they said, "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God." So now all the pretense about the king of the Jews is gone. Pilate's beat him up. Pilate's given him a way out. Now it just comes down to the bare bones. He said he's the Son of God. Well, interestingly, look at Pilate's reaction. When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. Why do you think that aroused fear in Pilate when they said he claims to be the Son of God or the Son of a God?
If you're reading along in John, you think about this phrase in one sense. Jesus has been teaching all along, and this is especially clear in John. He says things like, "I and the Father are one. Before Abraham was, I am. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." But to Pilate, he doesn't think Son of God, Yahweh, the God of Israel.
Right.
He thinks son of God, Caesar. Caesar is the son of God. Caesar is a deity. And there is no, when they say there's no king but Caesar, this is really what they're talking about. There is nobody higher than Caesar. To proclaim yourself the son of God is to usurp the role that is reserved for Caesar. And so the Jews are really playing this here. They say, hey, you know, Pilate, anybody who says this about themselves is no friend of Caesar's, no friend of Rome, kind of implying if you allow this to continue, you allow this guy to keep calling himself the son of God, the king of the Jews, these titles, are you really that loyal to Caesar? Because I thought only Caesar was allowed to call himself the son of God. And this is where Pilate starts to get very afraid.
I agree. He's afraid because of the magnitude of the charge. But also, Cole, you have to remember who he is. He's a Roman. He believes in a lot of gods, and he believes in the myths. So Jupiter, which is the Roman version of Zeus, the Greek Zeus, is the chief of the gods. But their stories of their gods are full of gods coming to people in human form. And they're full of stories of the gods taking wrath on human beings that don't treat them well. One thing John doesn't mention, but Matthew does, is during this process, and I just think this is fascinating, during this process, when he's offering them to release Barabbas, Matthew in chapter 27 says this, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, Pilate's wife sent word to him, have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream. What do you make of that little tidbit of information that also comes into play here? What, why does that fuel Pilate's fear in this situation?
Well, I think there's a minor point to be made here and a major point, and I'll do the minor point first. This is very interesting if you try to think about where did this dream come from?
Right.
So we think about dreams. Is this God? Is this demonic? You know, where did this come from? Because if the dream essentially is don't have anything to do with him, do not sentence him to death, whose best interest is it in to say that? It would be fairly odd for God to give her that dream. I mean, that's your first instinct, though, is to say this must be from God, doesn't want Jesus to be killed. But Jesus has been saying things in the Gospel of John over and over and over, things like, you know, I will lay my life down to in obedience to the Father. Nobody takes my life from me. I lay it down myself. These kinds of things, which makes you think, I don't know that God would give somebody a dream other than maybe alleviating their own moral culpability here. Is this a scheme of the devil? Is the devil onto the plot at this point that, hey, actually, I thought killing Jesus was the move. This is not the move, guys. This is actually going to backfire. I don't know. I don't know who I think this is from. It's a little bit of a quagmire.
Well, call me a cynic, but to me, the easiest explanation for this, and again, we're in the realm of conjecture here, let's just admit that, but the easiest explanation for me, I'm going to sidestep that whole theological landmine that you just put down, and I'm going to say, suppose that she has been watching what's going on in Judea, and she's heard word of Jesus and heard word of Jesus' teaching. She knows Caiaphas is a snake in the grass. She knows there's injustice happening here. Perhaps she simply has been tormented when she says suffered much in a dream. I couldn't sleep last night because I was thinking about this. Don't have anything to do with this righteous man. In other words, she has some sympathy for Jesus. She has a hatred, you know, of the political Caiaphas. It's possible that she simply has a soft heart for an unjust situation and consequently sends that message to him. So, again, this is purely conjecture, but I also think it's possible that it could just be that she doesn't like this situation. Jesus hasn't done this in a vacuum. People kind of know what's going on with Jesus.
Possible. I think the thing against that is if she slept since then. I mean, this all happens in a relatively short amount of time.
Well, that's true.
It's possible that she knows that this is coming from the triumphal entry or things that are going on in the temple courts when they get there. They probably, when they arrived for the Passover, they could sense that things were tense. And it's possible, like we said, that Caiaphas and Pilate had talked about this before. You never know. We don't really know much about Pilate's wife. In the tradition is that her name was Procula, but we don't know what her name was. We actually don't know anything about her. There is some conjecture that she was from a more prominent Roman family than Pilate was. Some people actually conjecture that this is why he gets sent to Judea, is he marries above his pay grade, somebody that's associated, a family that's close to the family of Tiberius, and Tiberius sends him off to Judea because he's not that happy about the marriage. We don't know. That's just conjecture. Mm-hmm. But if it is the case that she is from a prominent family, she probably has a sense about how these things tend to work out and the politics of the situation. And so that adds credence to this, to the point that you make, that she probably has a sense that whether this is from God or not, or whoever sent this dream, it might just be a typical stress dream, because she knows that there's no good option for her husband. It's possible. I still am interested in who sent the dream, but I don't have a good answer on what that is. But that's the minor point of what happens here.
Yeah. What's the major point here?
The major point is, if this is this dream just adds to the sense that Pilate must have had that there is something supernatural going on with this person.
Right. Oh, I completely agree. And, remember now, for him, the idea of supernatural isn't the same as we as Christians looking at it, like, oh, this could be the literal Son of God. No, that's not what he's thinking. What if this is a nephew of Jupiter, one of the demigods or one of the other gods, and they're here in disguise because they had a lot of gods, and that there is something divine happening? Maybe the gods have some kind of game going here that I don't know about, and Pilate does not want to get caught up in anything that's supernatural, particularly not the Roman pantheon of gods. And so I do think he's very scared. He's not just scared of the idea that, oh, a god is involved. He's scared of the idea that I could get, what if I kill a god in human form? I'm going to incur the wrath of the gods myself. So I think it kicks in his, what we would call, superstition, and makes him absolutely scared to death.
Mm-hmm. At this point, Pilate is just scrambling to remove himself from any kind of responsibility. He washes his hands of the situation. He tells them, no, you guys go crucify him. I find no guilt in him. Finally, when they say this, and it says he was even more afraid, he entered his headquarters again, and he says to Jesus, "Where are you from?"
And
Jesus gives him no answer. And Pilate says to him, "You will not speak to me." I have to imagine he's shouting at this point. He's nervous. I think he's angry. I think he's ready to be done with the situation. "Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" And Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." And from that point on, Pilate sought to release him. I think Pilate is just so freaked out. This is not good, but has no good way out. And they say, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. So he sits Jesus down on the judgment seat at the place called the Stone Pavement. And this was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." They cried out, "Away with him, crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he delivered him over to be crucified. How do you take what Pilate decides to do at the end of this story? At the end of the day, he does deliver him over to be crucified. But at the end of the day, he never finds him guilty of anything. What do you make of this?
Yeah, the way I typically look at it is, he is a consummate politician. He believes in the law of power. And when he starts to weigh his options, maybe he is a divine being, in which case the gods are going to smite me, but I don't really know that. But he does know at this point, despite everything he's done to try to release Jesus, not because Pilate's a good man necessarily, but because Pilate's trying to wriggle off the hook. But after everything he's done, he realizes, you know what? If I don't kill him, the Jews are going to get me. that this is so serious to them. And so I think he makes an expedient judgment, and that is, I'll take the devil I don't know over the one I do. I know that if I don't kill him, the Jews are gonna take their vengeance on me. And I think he makes an expedient decision. And this is fundamentally the decision we're all faced with. And that is, will I do what is true or will I do what is expedient? I mean, you could frame it that way. And I think Pilate makes the expedient choice. But what do you think about how this plays out?
Well, people are split about this, and you can see that in the response afterwards and the writings about what happened to Pilate. So just a few years later, as we mentioned, he's recalled. The following year, Tiberius dies, or maybe it's about the same time Tiberius dies. Eusebius, again, this is several hundred years later, reports that Pilate commits suicide sometime shortly after he's recalled from his post. It would be kind of career ending. But then there's a document that circulates, again, a couple hundred years later called the Acts of Pilate, which I don't think we should take as true in any sense, but is an interesting thing that people were reading and writing and thinking about, that he has a conversion, that he and his wife actually, after the resurrection, convert at the empty tomb. It's hard to know. I think the best thing that we can say about Pilate, and maybe one of the lessons we take from him, is he was somebody who didn't do the right thing, partially because he was trying not to do the wrong thing. See, that this is like playing not to lose versus playing to win. Pilate is trying desperately to not make the wrong decision, which prevents him from making a good decision. And what he thinks is politically expedient ends up coming back to bite him in a big way. Even politically, it comes back to bite him in a big way. And so one of the things I think is we have a person here who's, to go back to Jesus's conversation with him, who is standing in front of the truth, and he can't see the truth because he's too internally focused. He's trying not to do the wrong thing. He's trying to do the best thing for his career, and he gets lost and overlooks the greatest opportunity. One of the greatest opportunities anyone's ever had, a one-on-one conversation with Jesus about what it means to testify to the truth, what his life means, who he is, and all of that. I mean, the Gospel of John tells us that these things have been written so that we might know that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus says that to Pilate, and he misses it.
Yes, he does. I know. I think this is probably my favorite conversation in the Bible. And it is my favorite conversation because, as in so many ways, but one, it's like you said, Pilate's talking about the practicalities of here and now, and Jesus is talking to Pilate about Pilate and the choice he has to make between truth and power. And the ironic thing of the whole thing is that Pilate is pursuing what's the most powerful thing here, meaning what saves my skin, you know, where's the power lay here? Because that's the way I'm going to go. And in this conversation, you realize that although Pilate, who says to Jesus, I have all the power here, and Jesus says, I know that you think that, but you wouldn't have even this much power if it weren't given to you. And so we read this and we realize, wait a minute, when you read this, you realize Jesus is actually the one in control here. And yet, ironically, Pilate is looking to be in control of the situation. I just think this contrasts the ways of the world and the ways of Christ. It's such a stark contrast of the failure of humanity to pursue ourselves and our own ends when faced with the goodness and truth of God right in front of us.
Well, it's a perfect picture as we think about Holy Week as a whole. Jesus is put to death by the Romans under Roman rule, who was the most powerful empire maybe the world had ever seen. And yet by dying and rising again, Jesus would overthrow and uproot the Roman empire from the inside out. You know, in 300 years, the Roman empire would be mostly Christian, even though the Romans were the ones that put Jesus to death for what he was saying. And so in the same way with Pilate, we don't know. He washes his hands of the situation, but in another sense, the blood is on his hands forever. And we don't know where he went with that. It's possible that he repented. It's possible that he didn't. We just don't know. And so in some cases, you're left at the end of the Gospel of John with one of the last big encounters that Jesus has with a person, and you don't know where they stand.
That's a really great point, Cole, because first of all, you read this, whether Eusebius is right, he killed himself, which is, by the way, not the same as you would think of today. Romans would kill themselves because they lost honor, and death by their own hand was better. It's a different culture. But whether he killed himself or something else happened, the one thing no one thinks after they read this is, and Pilate lived happily ever after.
Mm.
No one thinks that. Whatever it was, his future, because of this event, is shrouded in darkness and negativity.
Well, we'll leave it at that as we move through Holy Week and the story of Pontius Pilate, the encounter with Jesus. In some ways, we're all confronted with the question that Pilate asked Jesus, what is truth? Jesus says, I've come into the world to testify to the truth. The truth is found in Jesus. And for all of us, we have to stand with Pilate and say, what do you believe the truth really is? And that's a lot of what we're doing this Holy Week, is taking ourselves back to that moment, to those questions, following Jesus out of the prefect's quarters and up to the hill of Calvary, where he will die and then rise from the dead.
Thanks for listening to the So We Speak podcast. If you like what you hear, go ahead and leave a comment, leave a review, email us, tell us what you like about it, tell us what you'd improve about it. Thanks to all you guys who are listening, and we'll see you next week on the So We Speak podcast.